Welcome to Trick Talkers, a podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. Occasionally. We're your hosts, Ryan. You're supposed to say Ryan.
And Patrick. We're introducing each other now.
That's kind of weird, but it works, right? It works.
Yeah, a little backwards episode. I like it.
Backwards episode, just like our backwards wizard tune that we play on our tea time episodes.
It's beautiful.
So we've got a lot to cover today. Some very cool hot takes. Quick one on Ito, Ryan. We had a discussion.
Ito again. Wait, we're going to talk about Ito. Was this the fifth time in 4 or 5 episodes?
People are going to be like, oh, I'm sick of hearing about Ito. That's all you guys ever talk about.
I know. We're going to become Ito talkers pretty soon.
Ito talkers. Well, I've called this Quick Ito, this segment. You called it Quick Ito, so it will be a Quick Ito. But just a little hot take on it, because I've played it with the OG, I'm going to call them the OG Ito crew when I first discovered it. I went to a con last weekend, which I was at when I also first discovered Ito a few months ago. It's like a con that happens every so often and on a regular basis. It's called HandyCon in the UK. Very cool. Recommend it. Very personal. It's all about playing games and people buying them potentially. Played Ito and came to the conclusion, Ryan, having played a few rounds of the basic rules, and I know Board Game Dojo, Eric put out a video to say, oh, you know, the rainbow version's better in his opinion. And I didn't agree with that first, but now I've come to that conclusion because the grandiose reveal feels great. But also, you know, when you're playing the base game and you're playing cards and you have a bit of this backpedaling and that's great. Well, sometimes you get a number and you see the number of, that someone else has played and you know you're next because you've got perhaps sequential order or you know they've played a 73 and you've got a 75 and you're like, right, it's me, it's definitely me, and the table knows that that might be the case. But with the grandiose reveal, if you lock your numbers in, you can't do that. You just have to. Of course, you could change your mind until everybody says, right, we're locked in, that's it, guys, let's go. So I do think it does allow the backpedaling still, but it also really tests how in sync you are as a group and pushes that to the limit. What do you think?
It takes away a little bit more of what the mind does as a game, because the whole point of the mind is playing the cards face up.
It is.
And then reacting to what the card was played and deciding, am I next? How long do I wait till determining if I am next or not? And with regular Ito, you're doing that, but you're actually talking, you're saying your categories. And it also lets you change your card a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like once you know a new number's come out, you can adjust from that number and change your category again, or your clue. Whereas with Ito Rainbow, you can change it. You're absolutely able to change your clue as much as you want. But because people haven't seen any other numbers, changing your clue might make things more confusing. So you really have to hone in on everyone's number. And I do absolutely agree, actually, that Ito Rainbow's reveal is way more exciting when everybody lays out the cards and you slowly flip them one at a time. And actually, the past couple of times when we've played and we've done the rainbow rules, we will just say like, okay, like we'll recap right before we flip the card over. We'll say, okay, this is Joe's and he said pie, and we'll flip it and then we'll do the next one. So it's like a sort of slow reveal saying each person's card and what it is. And when you get through everything, it feels really good.
100%. Yeah. It's that dopamine hit when you know everybody's played in the right order. You've all locked in and you, like you said, you flip them over one at a time. Because then that still gives you a little bit of the OG, shall I call it OG Ito feel? Is that the right word?
I guess. Yeah. Like you said, the dopamine rush is there more with Rainbow and how you reveal them. Allowing yourself more time and conversation in the original one makes it a little bit more relaxed and laid back. There's more pressure on the line in Rainbow on trying to make sure you get your one and done. I mean, I almost agree that I think Rainbow is better in that sense. But my reasoning really is because in original Ito, rounds 2 and 3 always have 2 or 3 cards.
Yes.
And a lot of people get overwhelmed when you get to that point. Most people enjoy Ito when it's the one card. When you start to explain, oh, by the way, we're doing the same thing, but now you have two cards and now you have three. Mm-hmm. They're just like, what am I supposed to do? I don't like, this is so many. I can, and people forget, and you have to repeat your cards over again. And by the time, you know, if you're playing with five people, everyone's gone through all three of their cards. That's 15. You have to re-go back through. And it's like, sure, you can play a card out, get the timer started, and then forget about that clue. But you still have a lot to keep track of. Whereas people really like the quick, fast point of the game of just playing one card.
Yeah. So I think, well, there was us with our Azul tiles as we quickly scrambled to proxy Ito Rainbow in the middle of our normal Ito game. And obviously that was a great decision. We found, Ryan, that just everybody having one card actually, from a memory perspective, and from, because we really go to town on it. We metagame the hell out of it. We drag in previous things that have occurred in previous rounds and bring them into the new round, and then other people bounce off that. It's absolutely wild. I think at one point I was having a tea party with a monkey who sadly died, and then I had to bury her. And then in a future round, the monkey kept coming back into the stories. It's hard to appreciate, of course, unless you're in the moment and in the game. And you always say that too. But yeah, we found one card, seemed to be optimum. And then we kind of created, it's like a sandbox. It gives you what you need. And then you sort of create the rules around it. We said that, you know, if something came sequentially, we'd give ourselves another life. We got through the level, we'd give ourselves another life. And we just kept seeing how many rounds we could do. And we found it really manageable with just that one card. So many things you can try at home. If you've got the base game, you can play Rainbow, just grab a few cubes, you know. So really, there's no bad way of doing this.
Yeah, I think either way you play Ito, you're still playing Ito. So I think you're going to have a great time. But I'm going to stop us here because we've already been going for a lot of minutes. This is turning into a not quick update, like we always do. But yeah. I love it, though. I love that you think Ito Rainbow is the better version of them as well. And I might agree. So
okay, the big U-turn. And
there we go. Yeah.
Tiny challenge update, Ryan. I am still on one game. But I went to the con. And there was this guy from Firestorm Games, a guy called Jimmy. And he had Sky Team behind him on the stall. And every time I went downstairs into the con, I looked at him and he looked at me, and there was this awkward, is he going to buy Sky Team now thing going on. Great game, by the way. I didn't buy it. So I feel like it's a good thing there was a bring and buy. You know, I sold quite a few games. There was a lot going on there. So dangerous stuff, cons.
Oh, yeah. There's games flying everywhere. Deals going, discounts, things that they'll add on to get you to buy the game. They'll always find something to spice up the deal.
Yeah, that's the problem. And First Contact, the game, my first game on the list, actually is now sold. And I...
Wow.
I only got it in January. Quick. Yeah, it didn't really...
Did you at least play it? Or did you just sell it after looking at it and realizing you didn't want it?
So First Contact, first play. First thing I then took to the... to go for sale in the con sort of momentarily afterwards the next morning.
Say no more.
There we go. I'll say no more with that. Moving on to some of the games that I played. I have finally now played, Ryan, Dog and Cat, the Team by M2K. So thanks to you, I bought it. And thanks to you, I've been pestering my group for the last sort of 4 months. Does anybody want to play Dog and Cat Team? You say bow wow and you say meow. Do you realize how difficult that was as a sales pitch?
It seems like because it took 4 months, it was pretty difficult.
Yeah, and then we're sort of saying, yeah, maybe not. We'll just give it a, you know, I said, well, it's like Llama, but it's better.
Is this the same group, though, that makes the animal noises when you play Nana?
So,
or are you forcing all of your teammates or players to make all these animal noises in games they don't want to?
It's a different group, but one of them sort of said, well, I won't be saying that, you know, I'll say meow, but I won't be saying bow wow. It was difficult, to say the least, to get played, but it got played. And actually, the group turned around at the end of it and said, that was pretty good. We enjoyed that.
Right? It's awesome.
So, result.
Okay. Yeah, it's quick, it's snappy, it's very light, very silly. There's lots of abilities. Every card has an ability. So I think Llama and I almost want to say Uno a little bit, even though whenever people hear Uno, they go, ugh.
Yeah.
Clearly, Uno, there's a reason why it's a very good game and it sells a lot. I personally don't like it, but this game has way more involved than Uno does, though. But the idea of the chaoticness with so much going on and drawing cards and discarding cards, passing things. But yeah, I'm glad to hear it went well for you.
Well, you know what, actually, we talk about the game being chaotic. We didn't find it that chaotic, and I actually somehow ended up with all the special cards in, as I doubt the game out. These are, like, just for context, little special powers. There's a vaccine where you can block things, and there's some other cards that let you do manipulate the deck. And most cards that get played in this wonderful little shedding, cute, artistic game have a power on them. And there are some milk cards where you can play with your dogs and your cats. And
so I know I've talked about this game in the past, but just in case for any listeners who might be confused about what the heck actually you do
people
in this game.
People are thinking,
game,
what the hell is Patrick talking about? Is there something wrong with him?
Yeah. Essentially, Dog and Cat the Team is a team-based climbing shedding game. The goal is to get rid of all of your cards. But the fun, quick little twist is, depending on the last card you play to play all of your cards will determine how many points you score. If you're on the dog team, you will want to play your last card as a dog card. It'll be worth 3 points. Whereas the cat suit, there's three suits, dog, cat, and then milk. So ideally, whatever team you're on, you want to play that card last. Like I said, every card has abilities. So when you play your card, you'll also trigger its ability. These range from drawing cards, passing cards to your teammate, making your opponents pass cards with each other, whether it's a random or a chosen, everybody passing a card to your left, various things like that. But ultimately, you're always trying to climb higher than the previous card played and play all of your cards out.
Right. I'm glad you jumped in there, Ryan, because I was milking it a little bit and I was thinking, somebody save me here from my cat and dog butchered explanation. However,
I mean, I don't think mine was perfect either, but I feel like maybe it gave a little bit more detail.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, mine went to the pound. So, recommendation is there. Dog and Cat the Team, if you can find it. You do need to pay stuff up. So don't blame me if you're there with a pair of scissors and sticker paper for God knows how long. But I do think it was worth the effort, you know, worth the time. So there we go.
And also, at the very least, if you want to have minimal effort, you can actually just print out a little player aid for each player that has all of the powers. You can stick it on the card to make it easier so you can just look at your hand and read what the ability is. But if you really don't want to spend the time making that kind of paste up, you can just print out a paper that has all of the numbers with their abilities and just people look at their hand, look at the paper, look at the hand. So, you know, again, reward versus effort, how much you want to do to make that worth it.
Yeah, and just for context, I like this. I'm not a massive fan of Llama. So, and Uno's okay, so, but this is, takes it to the next level a little bit, so make of that what you will. Another game, just wanted to mention here, was Far Away. Now, Far Away by Johannes Goupy and Corentin Lebrat. This game was introduced to us at the con by Flavien Loisier. My French isn't so good, apologies if I've butchered your name. I believe he was representing Gigamic and he has a website, hatchetboardgames.co.uk. He gets independent publishers together. This game, Far Away, was by far the most interesting thing card game wise, Ryan, I'd actually played at the con. Now, it's not a trick taker, and it's funny because I prefaced this episode with, we occasionally talk about other card games. This one's really neat. You can only play 8 cards. You draft cards. And when you play your card to take some cards from the center, because there's also a center with additional cards in that you can gain, everybody flips their card over at the same time. And the lowest number goes first. So you think, okay, well, that's cool. The lowest number is going to choose the cards in the center. And if you play sequentially, if you go up when you put your cards into your little tableau that you're building, with different characters and different colors and different resources, that's great because you get spicy cards. Now, the spicy cards give you additional ways to score. But if you don't play sequentially, Ryan, if you say you play a lower number than your previous number, then you don't get these spicy cards. But the whole game is such a little puzzle about how to optimize your engine and what order you go in to draft the cards from the middle to build into your 8-card tableau. Because then at the end, the game says, right, now you're scoring, but you're scoring it the opposite way to which you built your tab. You know, you've got your row of 8 cards, but then you score it in reverse. And you score it in reverse by flipping over all of your cards, apart from the last one. And it just makes it so hard to hit some of the scoring criteria, because until your previous cards are revealed, you're essentially got nothing in front of you. And I realize this sounds confusing, but it's really not. It's so clean, it's so smooth. And I'd encourage anyone listening who's curious by the idea of a crazy drafting game that scores in reverse to check out Far Away on BGG. Have you heard about this one, Ryan, at all?
Oh, yes. I've actually heard about this one back in September of last year, because one of our Discord users in our server, Romain Brie, has been nonstop talking about this game. I've been very interested in trying out this game. I know it's on BGA as well.
It is.
And one of my friends in my gaming group actually just imported a copy. So I will at some point be playing this game pretty soon. But Romain has played, I think, like over 60 plays of this and has talked about how awesome it is in the server. And hearing from you how awesome it is just really gets me more excited for it. And I'm looking forward to trying it out because it looks really cool.
Yeah, you could see in the player's eyes, oh, this is so stressful, but it's so great. I just can't get enough pineapples. Where are the pineapples? You know, you're having these conversations with yourself as you're playing, and it's just so great. The interaction doesn't feel negative at all, albeit, you know, you're drafting in the center. But I definitely look forward to hearing your thoughts on it, Ryan. And I know in the UK it's releasing in March at Aircon. I think it's going to be at UK Expo. Hopefully going to be more widely available in the States and elsewhere. So definitely one to keep an eye on if you get a chance to play it. Lovely little card game. Very quick mention, Flavian Luisa also introduced us to Belote Coinche, which we did one very quick round of, Ryan, which is a French card game. Apparently it's very cultural, and I appreciate, I've probably not pronounced it correctly at all, but it's a partnership trick-taking game where the trump suit has different values from the other suits. And I'm not going to go into a rules explanation of it. All I will say is, because I played a lot of games and things just come in and go out of your head, don't they, when you've got all these rule sets. So if you're curious about it, check it out. That's Belote Coinche. I did quite enjoy my first round of that just to get a flavor.
Nice. Yeah. Good old traditional card games.
A classic, yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's on to me to talk about what I have been playing recently.
Okay.
And both of mine are trick-taking games that I'm going to talk about. The first one is going to be Extreme Tricks, which is designed by Masato Uesugi, one of my new favorite designers, I think. He's amazing, makes fantastic games. And the idea of Extreme Tricks is predicting the number of missions that you think you will complete in the round. So every round, there's always going to be 12 tricks, whether you're playing 3 or 4 players, and there are always 12 missions. The thing is, there are 3 stages in the round. The first 4 tricks are stage 1, the next 4, 5 through 8, are stage 2, and the last 4 are stage 3. Within each stage, there are 4 missions, 2 of them which are red and 2 of them that are blue. The 2 red missions are missions that you complete during the tricks, and the blue ones are after all 4 tricks of that stage. So, for example, one of the red ones could be play a 7 or higher, or win a trick with a spade, things like that. And the blues are no tricks, or more tricks than everybody else. So there are things that you will evaluate after those four tricks are done. And you do these in those subsections of the different stages. So if play a heart was a mission in the first stage, and you don't play a heart until the second stage, you won't complete that mission. And you are predicting all of these before the round starts. So you look at your hand of 12 cards, you look at the 12 missions that are out there, and you decide out of 12 cubes, how many will you be placing? Essentially, how many missions are you completing?
Right. And is each stage, for clarity, is each stage a round?
All three stages is a round.
Right.
So you have a 12-card hand. You'll play all 12 tricks. That's one round. But each round has the three stages. So there's the first four tricks of your 12-card hand is stage one. And then the next four is stage two. The next four is stage three.
Right. So I have some questions, Ryan, on this one. I've looked at it with interest. Silly question to begin with. To what extent, it's got a skateboarding theme, does it feel like you're on a skateboard?
Very little to probably zero.
Okay.
The only reason why it makes you feel like that is because of the cover picture, which looks amazing.
That does look amazing. And to be honest, even if I had that on my... this is dangerous talk, by the way. If I had that game on my shelf for the cover photo, I'd say, well, look, it's a work of art. So it doesn't really matter, right? It's not really a game. It's a work of art. And then it's a game.
Well, the thing is, what's nice about this one is part of our challenge is print and plays don't count. And currently, the only way you can get extreme tricks is through print and play.
Well, that's cool.
Now, all play is going to be bringing it to the U.S. market, it seems like, in 2025. So it's going to be quite some time now. They're renaming it to Sick Tricks. But while you're waiting almost a year, 2 years, depending on when the Kickstarter actually launches, you can at least print and play extreme tricks and still play it. But yeah, the print and play is extremely basic. The red is literally, it's like a pinkish red, no background art. The blue is just blue. The only art you get is the front cover that shows a dude like on lava doing a kickflip or something over it.
Of course.
The missions don't...
lava kickflip.
Of course. What else would you be doing with the extreme tricks? But yeah, the missions themselves aren't trick or skateboarding themed. They're literally just play this type of card, win this type of way, lose this type of way, etc. Theme or no theme aside, the game is amazing. It is so much fun deciding how many missions you're going to predict at the beginning. You decide how many cubes you place or you are going to place. But at the very beginning, you must take half of those predictions and put them on missions. So if I decide at the beginning of the round, I'm going to complete six missions. Three of my cubes, I must place on three of the missions, saying those are the three I am going to do. My other three cubes I hold back in front of me, which can be placed on any of the other nine missions at any point throughout the round. Whether it's the one I thought I was going to do or not, I have that leeway. Like maybe I thought I was going to win a trick with a heart, but I never do. That other cube can end up going on the sum of all my cards is 21 or more.
Okay, and so I have a question then. So this game is available as a print and play at the moment. Is there any way that listeners can get hold of that, or is it a difficult task at the moment?
No, it's actually pretty readily available. We can even put the link to the documents in the show notes for people to grab. Now, as far as I know as well, I don't know if it's changed. There is no online implementation of the game because Misato wanted to keep it as a print and play only at this point. So we do kindly ask if you do get the print and play to keep it as a physical only version. Don't try to make any online implementation. Now, of course, if that changes, I'll say it in a future episode so we can let you know. But as of right now, just the print and play, which we can give to you.
Right, so you've got the print and play for the missions then, and have you then playing with the standard deck?
Yeah, it uses a standard deck of playing cards, the ace to queen, and ideally you actually have the numbers. Like instead of a jack and a queen, it'd be best if your deck was 11 and 12.
Okay.
Because certain missions focus on the actual value of cards. So, I mean, if you have a jack and queen, that's fine. Just remember that they're 11 and 12.
We'll get your marker out and... draw on that, vandalize that standard deck of cards. It's got to have a purpose.
Yeah, you need that and some cubes. You need 12 cubes in four different player colors, and then one extra cube to keep track of whatever trick you're on. So probably things you have laying around the house anyways.
Okay, so I've had several mission type games, and there's a lot of people listening that will have played The Crew. Perhaps some people will have played Pompiers, which is a competitive, or as people tout, the competitive version of The Crew, kinda. And also perhaps Washstick, the where you sort of put all the cards on the table and then laboriously each round flip them all over one by one. But then you've still got this the cool mission bit, right? Washstick, in its defense, as much as the drafting can be a bit monotonous. So what I'm trying to get across here, Ryan, is yes, you could say this might exist in that universe, but what makes it feel different? What sets it aside from those games where you think, actually, it doesn't feel like that, and even though it's got parallels?
The combination of Pompiers and The Crew almost comes together in Extreme Tricks, because Pompiers is everyone has sort of the same shared missions. You're all going for the same thing every round. It is public knowledge of that. And Extreme Tricks does a very similar thing. All 12 missions that are available, anybody can do. You can't block anybody from another mission.
Okay.
Which I guess is a little different in Pompiers. Only one person can score every round, whereas in this one, everyone can score.
Okay.
So there's a little bit more friendliness in that. But at the same time, you have an idea at what some people are going for. When you make those predictions, you know the number of things they need to complete, because that is public information. You also know some of the ones that they called that they are going for. And that could be the same as some players. It could be different. So there's sort of a shared incentive for certain players to make sure that others will miss certain missions. And I feel like in Pompiers, it's always just everyone for themselves. You're never really focusing on what somebody else did. Sure, you're looking like, okay, they're about to get three in a row, make sure somebody else wins. But you can't really do much to mitigate that. Whereas I feel like the missions in Extreme Tricks, some of them you can do all on your own. Like there's one that's just play a three or less. Doesn't matter who's leading, who's winning the trick. If you play a 3, 2, or 1, you can complete that mission. So it gives you the option to sort of do your own thing, but at the same time work with other people to mess around with stuff. I don't know if that's really conveying any information to make it sound better.
So what you're saying is, because obviously with The Crew, you know what missions people are doing. With this one, you've got the knownness of the missions that people have to commit to start with. And then what you're telling me is that later on, people can sort of go, oh, surprise, I'm going over here. You know, or I didn't expect that, you know. And then you're also saying, for context, Pompiers obviously is competitive and you're locked out. If somebody does it, that's tough luck. Whereas here, it's nicey-nicey, more positive interaction where you can be like, oh, do you know what? I've done it and so have you. And you're basing scoring, because you said, Ryan, that you know sometimes you it's in your interest to shut a player out and work together and have that cooperative nature, kinda. Is that based on scoring or where somebody's in front and you can sort of see?
A little bit, yeah, because the way scoring works is if you correctly predict one of your missions, you're going to score a positive point for it. But if at the beginning of the round, one of the cubes you place on a mission and you fail to complete that mission, you will lose 1 point for it. Additionally, any cube that's left over in front of you, so the ones that you could place anywhere you want, but you never managed to place, you will also lose a point for it. And then in the even worse situation, if you place all of your cubes, but then you're forced to place another cube on another mission, but you don't have any cubes left, you must take from your leftover personal supply that you didn't pick and put it on the -2 of the card.
Oh, ouch.
So the game rewards you for getting the exact number that you predicted, and you'll score all your positive points. But if you do too little or too much, you're going to start losing points.
Okay. We talk about sometimes dynamic bidding, Nikosu dice, segment tricks. And we also talk about hard bidding where you sort of have to say up front Dwas or Ghosts of Christmas. Does this feel like a hybrid between the two where you kind of commit to things to begin with, and then as the round flows on, you get a choice?
Yeah, I would absolutely say that's the case. The knowing how many you will bid at the beginning lets you know how many you must place. So typically, and also the fact that it's round down is important. If I only have five cubes, I only have to place two. If I do six, I have to place three. So deciding an odd or even number of cubes from the start is even just like a minuscule amount of decision that can set the entire round for you. Think the idea of keeping your missions hidden allows for more leeway for you throughout the round. If people know you're trying to take no tricks because you put the cube on that mission, well, then everyone's going to try and make sure you take a trick. Whereas you can surprise them by completing other missions with the cubes you have left over, makes it so that there's enough going on that players have to focus on themselves, but not so much that it's easy to figure out what everyone else is trying to potentially do.
That's really interesting, because the more I play Trick Takers, Ryan, the more I'm drawn to the dynamic approach over the fixed bid, albeit there are some exceptions, of course, with that. So to have a combination of the two, and there are obviously pros and cons to both systems, but to have a combination of the two does seem like that could hit a real sweet spot. So now that print and plays don't count, I am very, very tempted to grab this game and buy the skateboard. But I do need to know, what about balance? How does that feel? Because a lot of these games, we say, oh, well, it was great, but the scoring system, well, that wasn't so good. So tell me more.
I think it works incredibly well. So
right.
While it seems like it is dynamic bidding, though, it is kind of exact.
Okay.
You have to predict how many missions you're going to complete. And if you don't hit the exact number you bid, that's when you're going to start losing points. And when you read the rules, like just on a rules read alone, you're like, oh, this is going to be a lot of negative points people are going to have. This is going to end up being a game where the person with the least amount of negative points is going to win. It's actually not the case. It's relatively easy to hit certain missions. Like I said, the one where it's just play a specific card, you can't really stop somebody from doing that if they have that type of card in their hand and they choose that mission. That's a guaranteed point for them. Of course, as long as they do it within that stage, that's the appropriate stage to do it.
Yeah.
With all of that in mind, it makes the scoring not so difficult. There's really no runaway leader. There isn't too difficult of a problem, unless somebody like absolutely shits the bed and decides, course, well, I'm bidding all 12. I'm saying 12, and they have to complete everything and they get nothing. They make sure they miss all the missions. Like, there's no way you're not going to at least be 2, 3, 4 points away from the winner. Even if you have a bad round and the winner has a perfect round, as long as you got a couple positive points, you're probably only negating yourself to have 0 or maybe 1 or 2. Like in most of our games, I think actually, you know what? I'll even check. I got BG stats for a reason.
Yeah, there was, because we played that game together, Ryan. And the name has completely erased from my memory. It's a two-player trick-taking game, and we actually tried it randomly. Do you remember where we just sort of put out cards at random? And
oh, what game was that? I remember now.
The elusive.
That play. I don't remember the game.
Yes.
But yeah, we thought of the... it's the Lane Battler trick-taker.
Yes.
For Clans Conflict.
Yes, that was it. Yeah, and what I wanted to ask was, you said the points were really tight, and I just wondered,
is it so tight where it doesn't actually matter like that? Yeah. So I guess to give listeners a little context, I won't go too far in that game. Patrick and I played. Yeah, we played Four Clans Conflict, and I think the game is great. It's really good, but we ended up deciding, like, what if we just play cards randomly? Because we played a thing through a full game, and the points were so close to each other, we were like, well, is it going to actually matter? Like, did our decisions matter?
Does it matter? Right.
So we just played cards randomly, still following the rules, of course, must follow and et cetera. But like, we didn't think about what we were playing. We just made sure, did it match? And it turns out that the scores were still tight. Like, and it didn't matter really what you played, which is kind of sad. But anyway, with this game, it does matter. And this is, of course, just off of two plays, but it does matter what you play and when, because you're limited to only the four tricks during that stage when you can complete those missions. If you miss your window to complete that mission, you will get the negative points then. And then you start having too many negative points. And it can become harder to actually catch up to the person who is winning, because even if they have just an average round, they will still do well enough to keep ahead of you, even if you get a perfect round, because you could do bad enough in a round to get just enough negative points. So anyways, what I'm getting to here, the BG stats, my very first game was three players. It was 9-8-8. So okay, winner won by 1 point and the other two people tied. The second game I played, also three players, was 16-13-7. So a little bit more of a spread, but still relatively close enough. So it does give everyone the idea that there is a chance that you can still catch up and potentially win. But I don't think it's so much so that it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah, I mean, there was one stage where we thought that in the past about six nymph, but actually it does matter. And there are some really good players out there of that particular game. But going back to extreme tricks, essential award, interesting award, where are you at the moment? We're saying people really should try this now it's available, because why not?
Oh, that's a good question. I think to start right now, it gets the interesting award.
That's interesting.
It is very interesting. I'm a big Masato fanboy. More and more every day as more and more games come out from him. And just, I guess, in case anyone doesn't know, Masato is the designer of Duel Boy and Duel Boy Pocket.
Well, that would explain it, Ron. I didn't make the connection at first, but that's become very, very clear to me now, the love for Masato as well.
Yeah. Also, designer of Lunar and Welcome to the Dungeon, probably some other games you might have actually seen full published versions. What Extreme Tricks does with the missions and how it plays out, how you bid for them, how card play is relatively straightforward, must follow with Trump, makes it a really interesting play. It's one of the games that after my first play of it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And everybody in our group has loved it. Everyone is at this point looking forward to when Sick Tricks comes out to have an official version. I do honestly believe this will become an essential and win the essential award for me.
Exciting.
But because it's a print and play only right now, and I know not everyone is big into doing print and plays. Of course, there's almost no art on the game itself. It looks pretty drab on the table. So it's going to be hard to get people into that. I think it just gets the interesting award for now.
Amazing. Don't forget to put Heaven is a Half Pipe on in the background while you're playing it. That is a throwback. I'm really showing my age here. Tony Hawk, the Trick Taker. Just add a ring to it. Right, let's just move on. I've had enough of my own puns. I don't normally do that.
All right, but before we move on, I want to ask you a question, because you've been asking me a lot of questions. They've been great. Right. They've been putting me on the spot, but I want to put you on the spot. For the all-play version, we know Allplay is a huge fan of upgrades. Mm-hmm. Every game they make always has some crazy, ridiculous, grandiose addition, whether it's necessary for the game or not. Sick Tricks is what they're going to be calling it. It seems like they're keeping the skateboard theme. So you think is going to be the upgrade components for this game that Allplay will make?
So knowing Allplay, as I know them, and what we've seen with Hamlin Cave going into sale and the massive wooden figurines that made it quite complicated to pass the board, putting it politely, but were cool to look at. I can see perhaps Ryan here as having little meeple skateboarders. Perhaps they screen print them, perhaps they gold emboss them, standing on the, instead of the cube, standing on the mission cards, undoubtedly, and they'll probably find a way of deluxifying it to a point where it might be there'll be some kind of overproduction is what I'm trying to say here. And fair, you know, that it will be a successful campaign, I'm sure, but I think there'll be some components where it's not optimal for usability just because it's deluxified. You of the same mind?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. All plays upgrades are almost unnecessary, borderlining impossible to actually use. I played Mori last night as well in our group, and there's the like wooden tokens that have the X's on it. Uh-huh. And there's no real mention of what they're used for. I sort of made the assumption you're supposed to replace them with the X cards and the dice when you gather them. Yeah. So instead of having to put them and confuse which ones are on your card that you can still play or not, you're supposed to just like move them to the side and take the tokens. But when you go to the Kickstarter page, it just says wooden tokens. And there's just like no mention really of what they are. So just unnecessary thing.
Yeah, it's almost like, hey, we're doing a Kickstarter campaign, and what else can we add to give perception value for money? And Kickstarter backers, they're going to expect something, so we need to do something. First player marker, though.
I think it's going to be a tech deck. That's my hope.
Tech deck. Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, different.
Yeah.
Yeah, the little skateboards that you had in the 90s. Where do little tricks. That would be so cool. And to be honest,
oh my gosh, it'd be amazing. I would actually get an early copy if that was what the case was.
That would put the sick in the trick.
It would. It really would. But no, I agree. The Meeple skateboards is around what I was thinking for placing on the cards.
Yeah, an unnecessary way to add to the coolness factor and the, I dare say, fun, adding to the fun. But it sounds like it's a really fun game. And play it, and if not, look out for the all-play Kickstarter in a couple of years. But we all know most people can't wait that long, so they'll probably try it out beforehand once they've heard this episode.
I was hoping. It'll be good. You'll be missing out. Don't miss out like I did with Ido and waiting forever, even though you see it and hear about it.
Exactly. We just watch from the sidelines, and then good thing we're not having Ito in a Royal Rumble, Ryan, because that would be destroying things, and it's not a trick taker, but it could be like a Joker.
Oh, it'll be a Joker. It'll win the whole thing. So I don't think it's never eligible to take place.
Put it to a vote. And what number would it be? There you go.
All right. Well, I think it's a good time to move on to my other game, and that is going to be Shock Knights with Poison, which is designed by Jujin Otsubu. And we are specifically talking about the new revised edition. Now, this edition was quote-unquote released back in December of 2023, where Jujin, the designer, sent out a tweet that basically had the print-and-play files. So it seems like both these games I'm talking about are print-and-play.
Continuing the print-and-play theme here, right?
Exactly. Specifically, the new revised edition is only available as that print and play, and it does make some gameplay changes, which we'll, of course, be discussing today. I actually own the original edition. I have that copy still. So for me to be able to play this new edition, all I really had to do was print out the treasure deck. The deck makeup and all the other components that you have in the original, you can still use with this one.
Well, that's music to my ears, Ryan, because I confess that I've already, as you know, Ryan told me about this today. He said, yeah, I've had a good time with it. So straight away, got my standard deck of cards out into opaque sleeves and printed off this new dungeon deck. You can't really use the old dungeon deck. It's sticky, it's smaller, and the deck makeup is very, very different. I mean, I looked at it at first and I thought, I can't see what's different. And then I looked at it. And then I was like, well, this is very different.
Significantly and different, yeah.
Without stealing your thunder, Ryan, why is it different? If you can explain to people in terms of how the game's played and how it feels.
Yeah, so the quickest way you'll ever hear anybody talk about Shock Knights with Poison is it's Ink and Gold the Trick Taker. It is a push-your-luck trick-taking game. It's played over 5 rounds, and you're trying to collect the most gems in your little baggie. There's this treasure deck that will tell you essentially how many gems you'll get, along with some cards that are played during the trick. And in the original version, the treasure deck was only 12 cards. There were 6 poison cards and 6 just regular treasure cards. In this game, poisons are bad. You don't want to be poisoned.
Yeah, the theme, 50-50 thing, right? Before.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas now the new revised edition has a much larger treasure deck. There's 24 cards in total. 18 of them are the safe treasure cards, and 6 of them are still the poison cards. So you're more likely to draw a better card than the poison card. Because when two of the same poisons are either revealed from the main treasure deck or the cards, because the actual deck on the sevens of the three suits, there are the three different poisons that you can have. If a player ever has two poisons, they're eliminated from the round. So knowing that the deck is bigger is a huge change. It changes the dynamic of potentially how long you might stay in the round.
So this is almost a different game. I mean, this is a drastic change to Shock Knights with Poison. This isn't just a minor, oh, we changed a couple of rules. This is a huge overhaul of how the luck and how the discovery of gems versus being eliminated plays out throughout the entire round game.
Absolutely. The other big change with it too is in the original version, the winner of the trick just revealed the top card of the treasure deck, and whatever was there they got. That was it. In the new version, they can decide to draw 1 to 3 cards. So there's actually more of a push your luck element. How many treasure cards do you want to open? The other thing on top of all of that is the makeup of the gems on the treasure cards has changed significantly because, and this is one of the better parts, I think.
I was waiting for this part.
Yeah, it is the gems in the original, only the winner got. In the new version, every other player actually has a chance of getting gems as well. The art on the cards is actually really nice. It shows like two adventurer hands with gloves holding big gems, and then there's little gems that are on the ground outside of that. So it lets you know the other players will actually collect those. The dynamic of this game has changed significantly because now the players who don't win tricks actually have something to look forward to and have a reason to stay in longer.
And that's what makes a game like Concordia feel great, right, Ryan? Because it's getting stuff. Everybody likes getting stuff. It feels positive. It doesn't feel... And this is not having played it, of course, this particular change. But in games, receiving things always feels nice.
100%. Everybody wants to get things. Especially the gems. You get to grab those little gems, put them on top of your nice cloth bag. It feels great. With the original... If you had a bad hand, like if you had a low hand, pretty much in this game, unless it's Trump, low numbers are never really that good. And if you can't win a trick, you can't get gems. And it would just force you to stay in the round longer to wait until everybody else withdrew or had two poisons from getting a card and one from the deck. And by then, the round would usually end. There would be rounds where people wouldn't win tricks and they wouldn't get gems.
Miserable, right?
It was pretty miserable, yeah. And with the new deck... Because you can get those sort of passive gems from not winning, it gives you an incentive to stay longer because you can get more gems, but also it makes you want to be more involved and then actually decide to back out early. Oh, I've collected 4 gems after 2 tricks. I'm good. I don't need to stay any longer. You guys keep going. Sure, you're going to bust and I'll be fine. I'll be the only one with 4 gems.
So... Are you telling me then, I know there's a couple of things that you weren't so hot on, one thing specifically, but before we come to that, are you telling me that we're rewriting history here and effectively all the previous, there's a lot of BGG reviews on this and some of them are very positive, they've had a good time, but there's quite a few, I remember reading historically when I looked into this game, Ryan, that say, well, you know, I got shut out, didn't really have a choice, I... didn't get any gems and you can just have bad luck and you're at the mercy of the draw. Are we saying now that this has definitively fixed a fundamental flaw? I mean, it was perhaps as the designer intended originally, but a perceived flaw. Has that now been fixed, in your opinion?
I would say it's still got a push your luck element to it. So if a lot of people didn't like that part... because of getting shut out or feeling like they didn't have any control over the random deck, that's still going to be there. So I don't know if it'll change their mind. But absolutely, I think it has fundamentally changed the game in a better way, where if people didn't like it because they thought the round ended too early, they didn't have enough chance to get any gems, and they felt like, oh, this person won three tricks in a row, got seven gems, and then passed while I got nothing, and then the round ended the next trick. That's not really going to happen as much in this one, and I'm hesitating and long saying my words there, because unfortunately, the thing you were alluding to earlier still exists in this game. And what that is when you set up the treasure deck, you just randomly shuffle it. You put all the cards together, okay, you shuffle it, and you go. Which can mean the first two very cards that you draw after the first trick could be the two poisons that end the round. Now, right, that's an extreme case.
It's extreme tricks.
Extreme tricks. There you go. There are enough times I've played this game where within the first one to three tricks, two poisons have been drawn from the deck and the round ends. And that always feels anticlimactic. It doesn't feel fun. The point of the game is to push your luck. You're trying to see how far you can go into the round to really get deep into the dungeon or deep into the treasure chests now and see how many gems you can get. When you can't really get that going, it doesn't feel as enjoyable. And unfortunately, even though the deck is larger and there's more regular gems, random luck is still there.
But assumably, I'm not sure how many times you've played the new version of it, Ryan, but that is the chance of that happening is now being diluted, right? So that you're much more likely to have a fulfilling game than you were before on the 50-50.
Yeah, whatever the math is, I'm definitely not a mathematician. I'm sure somebody listening can give us the exact numbers, but it's 18 gems and 6 poisons versus 6 and 6. So that's very quick math. I know you can do it, but it looks like you're doing it. Isn't it like 33? I'm gonna take that out.
Yeah, it's a 33%.
Oh, it is. Hey, look at me knowing math. I'm keeping that in then.
Well, there we go. 6 into 18.
Yeah, I mean, that's like probably basic math you learn in first, second grade. I don't know. Kids these days, what do they learn?
Exactly.
Back to the point, though, that really makes the game sing more. It was really fun watching our group. And I've only played the new version once. So take all of that with just this one play. But I've played the original game a handful of times. So I understand the flow. I know how it works. But in our game we did play last night, we had two rounds end within the first four tricks. So that still does happen, even though it's a much smaller percentage. You can calculate the numbers all you want, but dumb luck can still be dumb luck, and it can happen.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. Now, it seems like a positive change for the game. Now, the one thing that you might be indifferent on, Ryan, is there are no sober cards, and to be clear, the sober cards were kind of like an advanced variant. They were like extra poisons, right? A little mini expansion. That's not in the new rules.
At least on the print and play files you got and on the rules. It seems like the entire reason and decision of the revised version is to streamline the game. They took out the sober cards. They're trying to make this deck a little bit nicer and friendlier for more people involved. Mm-hmm. But they also took out, which I actually think, I'm fine with the sober cards not being there. What I was a little upset on, I don't know if upset's the right word, but the way, when the round ends, everyone shuffles all the cards back and you deal a new round, like most trick-taking games.
Yeah.
But in the original version, whenever somebody withdrew from the round, you're like, I'm not playing any more tricks. I'm out. I'm done. I'm going to take my crystals and go home. You'd still play one of your cards from your hand face down, and the other players who would win the trick would get a gem for that. But you'd still keep your hand. And at the end of the round, you'd draw back up. So you actually got to do some hand management of holding on to cards for the next round. Well, they got away with that to streamline it. And it's just now, if you withdraw, you just put your whole entire hand down and you're just done. And then at the end of the round, you collect the cards and you just shuffle and deal them. Now, you still give a gem to the player when you withdraw. That hasn't changed, but it's just you don't get that hand management part anymore, which I guess was better in the original because you needed those high numbers to win, because you only got gems by winning. But now that you can get gems without winning, I guess it's less necessary. Maybe there's that. I don't know. I don't hate that it's not there anymore. I'm just a little sad that it's not.
I think I prefer it to play tactically. From a tactical perspective, playing a card face down when you go out, and also managing the cards that you keep in your hand, I think is really clever, because you can take them into the next round and you can really think about what cards you're taking through to that next round. So for me, even though I can see from the perspective of trying to streamline the rules, or as Ryan said, which everybody's going to be saying when they're going to work now, I'm going to take my crystals and go home. I think we're onto something now. That will start trending on X, as they call it nowadays, and we'll see what happens. But I think you've hit the nail on the head, Ryan. For me also, I know that I'm going to be more drawn to the original rules in terms of keeping cards. But from a 50 to a 33% chance, now we've done all the homework and the maths on it, seems like it's going to be a better game for it. And I am hopeful that they not only keep it in a print and play form, but also reprint it. And I know that's something you might want to talk about, so we can hopefully drum up some support.
Absolutely. It's a good thing you bring that up. Because right now, the only way you can get it is print and play, because there hasn't really been enough buzz to make an actual reprint. Jujin has posted on Twitter, or X, I guess. I'm going to just keep calling it Twitter. That's what I've been calling it.
Just Twitter, just X. It's like, yeah, it doesn't feel right,
people know.
X?
People know. Anyway, they posted print and play stuff, but they also said, if anyone is interested, you know, let me know. This is the only way I'm really going to know if it's worthwhile to reprint this game. As most of us can probably imagine, you know, printing games aren't cheap, and going out on a limb and spending all that money for games not to sell, because especially if it's not going through Kickstarter or any crowdfunding service to get money up front, that's a huge risk you can take. So letting them know and supporting them and telling them, hey, this game was great, I tried your new revised edition, or I have the original, I'd love to see this happen, would be really good. I've already posted. I know one of my game buddies that played last night, they posted on there, and a few other people have. And Schultzy, who is someone we've talked about before on the show, he makes a lot of really good print and plays for a lot of out of print games. Didn't make the print and play for this. Just this is already from the designer. Yeah. But Schultzy has been doing the work at trying to get this game out there too. So big ups to Schultzy for doing that. I know he's posted on the BGG page and posted in the PGC Discord server. Has really been trying to push it out. So I hope that along with that and us, just more and more people get it out there, and we can hopefully make this thing more of a reality.
Yeah, well done to you keeping up the support for the Japanese indie designers. I know, for example, Ryan, Cauldron 15 was a nightmare to get back into print at one point, and the designer was sort of saying, well, you know, I have to save up for it, it's going to take some time, and she eventually reprinted it. But like you said, it's no easy feat. We take it for granted we've got All Play and all these new releases coming out, but actually, you know, a lot of these designers need our support and need that extra push to motivate them to reprint a game. Let's show them that it is in demand, and it is a lovely production. The artwork on Nights with Poison is
beautiful.
Absolutely, they smashed it out of the park, haven't they, with the artwork on the deck. I'm not talking about the print and play, which is also great. I'm talking about the actual production here as well.
Yeah, no, actually, I love the new art for the treasure deck. I think it's great.
Yeah,
I know it's a subtle change, but it looks really good. And don't want to try and say it's like for every single game, like, oh, this game's great, make it happen. Mm-hmm. There's too many games that do that. But for this one, this is a game that I have enjoyed since I bought the original copy years ago. And sadly, I have not played it enough. And after playing again last night, it's really refueled my love for it. And I know this has been a grail game, or a very hard game to find for a lot of people who have wanted it. So what better way to make that happen than let him know you are looking for this game? You'd love to have the new revised edition.
Shock. Let's get a reprint.
Let's make it happen.
Did that work?
Might have worked. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to move on from it, though.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. I know we didn't write it down, but I sort of mentioned played Mori last night. Also played Lunar. Mori is designed by Daniel Newman, and Lunar was designed by Masato Uesugi, my boy.
Surprise, surprise. There we go. There's another Masato. Classic.
Of course, classic. I don't want to spend too much time on them on this episode. We might do maybe an all-play episode in the future or something. But I actually want to say they didn't go so well for our groups, or our group.
Okay, and what happened, Ryan? Why didn't they land with your groups?
Lunar, I think, was a little more problematic because we've all played Dwas, or Charms, as the new version will be. And everybody just kind of liked that one more. Being able to create both the suit and number yourself versus the team way of doing it was a little bit more cohesive. It felt like you didn't have a lot of decisions to make.
Okay.
Card play, knowing that if your partner played a suit or a number, you had to play the other thing. And a lot of times tricks were inevitable by the time it came to you, because usually the opposing player would play either a higher number or the trump suit potentially, or just like a suit that would win. So a lot of times the third and fourth player, who was just finishing off the card to make it match, didn't really have a good choice to like make a meaningful decision in that trick. Of course, you still want to manage your hand about what you're playing throughout the round, because you are worried about how many tricks you take. The scoring in that game essentially is based on the number of tricks. There's a scale, sort of like Fox in the Forest. You either want no tricks or like a average to higher amount, but you don't want all of them. And there's also cards that have stars on it, which are worth points no matter how many tricks you take. So sometimes you can go for tricks and still go for the stars and get a little bit, whereas another team doesn't. I don't know. Again, I feel like I'm already talking more on it than I wanted to, but that's probably why that one didn't land. And with Mori, our group actually we stopped. We didn't play the full game.
Okay.
We only played two rounds.
So you didn't want Mori of it?
No, we did not want Mori.
Okay. What happened with Mori then, as opposed to with Luna?
Well, the suits, for one, the art from Beth Sobel is great. Like it should be great, I should say.
Okay.
But the suits, like the yellow suit, impossible to read. Everyone at our table, you played a card, you couldn't see what the number was. And
no, that's not great. You know, from a graphic design perspective, it's not ideal.
Yeah. The skulls and leaves on the cards, which are supposed to be right in the middle, are extremely tiny. So it's hard to see how many points a card is worth positively or negatively. There were colors behind the skulls in the middle that were slightly different than their suit colors. So it was confusing people on like what the actual suit was. The Trump hierarchy of the previous suit beating out the next suit was on the little placard in the middle where you put all the dice, which was nice. And on your little player aid card. So that was helpful.
Okay.
That was probably one of the better things, was that.
Right.
Just the overall graphic layout design of it was a little not so great. And of course, the all play rulebook is super tiny, so it missed out a lot of rules and things, which I know because I'd play tested the game before, weren't included on there, whether it was an old iteration or not. It was missing some things, so people were confused. A lot of people didn't feel like they had a lot of interesting decisions on the cards you play, like with the dice and the cards, because really, it's almost like a trick avoidance. You just didn't want any of the skulls. Keep some cards in your hand, but you had to get dice to make that happen. I know this is very incoherent thoughts.
Sorry, Ronnie, you basically translated me a message here, and I feel like it's just come in, it's telepathic, and you're saying to me, I would rather be playing Nikosu dice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all would.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
That was a poor way of explaining the game, and I'm sure no one can probably figure out why we didn't like it. And I'm sure if I had more time to actually think about it, because I wasn't planning on talking about this today. Here we are.
I like it. It's impromptu.
Yeah. Let me see if I can gather my thoughts for like a second.
Okay, I'm good.
So the dice in the middle are supposed to be things that players will grab, because it is a must follow trick taker unless you play a die. The dice allow you to make it a may follow. Even if you have that suit in hand, you can play a die, whether that's going to make you win because you'll trump in or you'll be off suit to not win. It gives you that leeway. But ultimately, the whole point of it is to collect the leaves and avoid the skulls. There's also this additional thing with the X's. There are these X cards you can play, which are essentially zeros. And the dice also have X's on them, which can count as zeros. If you have the most X's at the end of the round, you're going to lose a point for every X you have. And if you have the second most, you're going to score points. So there's sort of like a set collection-y push your luck, not having too many of them.
Right. Okay. I mean, I said to my group the other day, I said, the more I play these trick takers and card games, obviously we've got a lot of designs that have, dare I say it, Ryan, gimmicks or novelty ways of doing things, and that's cool. And it might be cool for the first couple of plays, right? But then you look past that and you say, what actually is this game? Is there agency in it? Is it fun beyond the gimmick that's laid out? And I say gimmick loosely because there are only so many ways to reinvent the wheel. We do see nice things. I mean, Extreme Tricks is perhaps a really good example of something that's doing something different and creating a different feel. But what actually is there, and is it fun, and is your group enjoying it? And it sounds like these flopped pretty hard for you. And obviously, not taking away anything here from Daniel Newman. He's got, you know, an enemy supposed to be well regarded. I've not played it, and kindly reprinted Dwas as charms and
also Reapers.
Something.
Reapers he designed, which is great. Yeah, I mean, of course, this is all just from me again. My coherent or incoherent rambling right now.
And our group.
Our group didn't like it. That doesn't mean yours won't. I've heard from people who have enjoyed it. It's just the flow of that game just didn't really work for our group. None of us really felt like we were making meaningful decisions. And whether it's Nokus Dice or Rebel Princess, which we had played right after that, mm-hmm. we all felt like there was just other more enjoyable games that we've played as a group that we'd all rather play.
And to be honest with you, graphic design wise now, it has to be on point. I mean, flashbacks of David and Goliath, the yellow tin, Ryan, putting that on the table and people looking at it and going, I can't see the yellow suit. There's really no excuse for it now. And it's just such a usability and barrier that's unnecessary, that can easily be avoided and should be something that's really thought out. And rule books as well, all play have this thing where you're condensing rules, and that's nice because you've got a small rule book. But like you said, we had this problem with Nine Lives. You've got the all play rule book, great, but then you're missing key rules, and people are, you know, I had to tweet Taiki Shinzawa to get information that was pivotal to how the bidding works, to how the game works. And you expect that, okay, not so much with Japanese trick takers because we're there translating them, but you expect that games have been picked up by Western publishers. They're going to give you the rules, the essential tools that you need to interact and play the game in English, preferably Western publishers.
Yeah, it's sad. And I know we're sort of shitting on all play here, and we're not trying to. Again, it's amazing what they're doing and bringing over, and it's great that they're making these games more readily available to people. But the thing is, we're not the only ones who have complained about these specific issues, and especially the rule books. Everyone I talk to, I've not heard a single person that said all plays rule books are good. They're always bad. They always leave people with more questions than anything. They pride themselves on only having the one piece that, you know, that folds. And it's like, just add an extra. You need the couple more pages. It's fine. One staple won't hurt you. It's better to make your game make more sense instead of frustrating people by trying to make your rules so small that you leave things out.
Well, the only way to bring about change is to discuss it and chat. So hopefully if AllPlay is listening as constructive feedback, please do something with the rule books and also look at the graphic design. It's hard to comment on the design of the game itself unless you, of course, actually play it. I haven't. I get what you're saying, Ryan, and I do appreciate more and more, like I said to you, clean designs, looking past novelties and saying, is there actually a game here that really sings? And I don't know about you, Ryan, but a lot of the trick takers that I play, quite often is the case where I put them on the table, they don't necessarily land. Maybe they're fine out of 10. Maybe they're just okay and everybody has a good time. But how often do you find yourself saying, oh, I wish I was playing the Kosu Dice, or maybe just play the crew, or just Rebel Princess, or, you know, Shock Knights with Poison. And it's sort of getting through the fog, and you know the answer already, but it sometimes there's just so much to go at, it doesn't feel like it's possible to get to the gems that you know are gems.
Of course. And I mean, that's the thing you're constantly chasing all the time, though.
Discovering the new Ito, right? Discovering that play that could be.
You never know what you might be missing out until you play it. And that's the thing we're always chasing, which is always the problematic. You spend 3-4 times playing a game. Well, you know, you spend that night playing 4 or 5 games, and maybe only one of them was actually worthwhile, but you had to play the others to find out. Was it worth it in the end? Who's to say?
Exactly. And I've been brutally culling, and with that in mind, and some games that I even respect a lot and regard as great games have just gone, and some not even played. I mean, Gadget Trick, it went. Haven't even played it, Ryan. But from what I've heard, and it's just that
fine.
Time.
You're okay, missing. I don't know.
I'm safe. There we go.
Yeah.
One thing I need to say, and this is a great point in the episode to bring it in again. So the whole point of us doing the challenge was obviously to try and get better at identifying the games we want. I've given you a challenge update at the start of the episode. Ryan, what's your current number?
Ooh, great question. My number is actually at 2 now. I have gone up by 1.
One for half the month and one for the second half of the month?
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that.
Okay. So what have you gone for?
The Earthborn Rangers Kickstarter or Game Found has launched today. I was able to play this game in person with one of my buddies who owns the base game now. I was afraid this was going to happen, but I really enjoy the game. I mean, anyone who knows, I love to play Marvel Champions. Uh-huh. And, you know, that deck building, construction, playing out, cooperative-esque, fighting things, adventuring is what Earthborn Rangers does. But there's actually a more campaign, more story to it than Marvel Champions has ever really done. And I love the gameplay. The mechanics of it work really nicely. It's an RPG-esque flow to it. You can advance along things, and you can feel like the theme of the game really oozes in this one. It feels like you're actually doing the different tasks or being in the different areas as you play or do the things. I really loved it. And I was like, after the one play, I don't know if I should back it because it's a big commitment.
Okay.
Well, I played, there's also a tabletop simulator mod for it. And I played through that a little bit, and I'm like, oh man, I'm going to get this, aren't I? And at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time this morning, I backed it.
Okay, because I've heard good things about Earthborn Rangers. Not a trick taker, obviously.
Yes, big board
RPG
game.
Style. Okay, interacting with things. I've heard that the latest edition has addressed some of the errata in the first version, because I think there was a lot of text on cards previously they had to tweak.
Yeah, there's an errata pack you can get now that they'll have.
Okay, well, one to watch, and if anyone's got any interest in Earthborn Rangers, which is supposed to be highly thematic, I've heard good things from my group. Don't own it myself. I would like to give it a go. Well, I guess Tabletop Simulator is one way of doing it.
They do have a print and play. That's a lot to print and play, though. That's a huge effort. You're probably just better doing the tabletop mod. But if you really need to do it physical, they do have the like tutorial part you can print and play and get.
Yeah, I was going to say, Ryan, you've taken on some big print and play projects throughout in the past. You know, I've seen you make these lovely 18XX boards with all the bits. So, and obviously Trick Takers, that was a massive print and play. So you do take them on, you do them. So it is a thing, and that is another good way to curb the spending. But I get it. You know, the production is probably going to be really nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The whole sustainable everything, no plastic. Their whole mission on that is really nice as well.
Yeah, I like it. Okay, well, this episode went to some interesting places that I didn't expect, but I've enjoyed the discussions, and hopefully people will see it as a constructive episode. I know we've been negative in some degree, but hopefully people will see that as being negative to bring about positive change and just getting the thoughts out there about our genuine opinions and our experiences with our groups. We always want to be honest with folks.
Yeah, and I mean, you can't love everything. If we always you came can't. On here and only talked about your favorite game, which there's nothing wrong with that too. Definitely don't want to say that either. That's sometimes what these are for. Sometimes you just want to come on the air and create a podcast just to talk about all the things you love. That's sort of the idea of it. But sometimes you also want to talk about the things you didn't. And it also, I feel like, helps listeners to get an understanding of what we like and don't like personally, like what I do and don't like, to let them know if it aligns with them. Because I know for myself, whenever you watch reviews of something, whether it's on YouTube or a podcast, after a while, you get the idea and the vibe of that person and understand if their recommendations will be for you or not. And I think if you always only ever talk about the games you like and why you like them, and not also games you didn't like and why you didn't like them, you're not going to have the full broad spectrum of their understanding. So I think that also helps. Maybe. This is maybe just me defending my incoherent ramblings as well, but who knows?
No, I like it, Ryan. Ryan does ramble, but one thing I will say, the great thing about Trick Talkers is we're not sponsored. We don't have anybody sort of saying what we can and can't say. We're kind of unfiltered here. We're not getting, in most cases, we don't really get games given to us or bunches of Trick Takers. So we're going out there like consumers, buying games, trying games. And that means that we can help people make informed decisions because, you know, it's not just Cult of the New. We're not getting tired. We don't treat it as a commercial operation. We just see it as something that we love. It's our hobby. And therefore, we can talk freely and give our opinions in the best way to you guys at home.
And there's our sales pitch for Trick Talkers. Hope it went well.
There we go. Hopefully. Does that mean that the outro is going to go well in a second when people check us out on, I nearly said X, but I'm going to say Twitter, and maybe want to interact and talk to us and say, see if they agree with our opinions or maybe enjoy the show, or going to start a petition to get Shock Knights with Poison out there again?
That'd be great. Absolutely let us know, whether it's on Twitter or in our Discord server. Come and join us there. Have some great conversation with great folks. Or you can email us at tricktalkers@gmail.com as well. And of course, we have our link tree that has all of our other links to everything else we might have related to the show.
Like Trick Talker t-shirts that I really should own a t-shirt of to say to the world, hey, I'm from Trick Talkers.
You should get the tote bag too. I use that for my games. It's very nice.
There we go. I really should. So yeah. The irony, but there we go. And with that, I will say goodbye.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for listening to another episode of Trick Talkers. We'll see you around.
We'll see you around.